My name is Jerry Diamond. I'm from Kalamazoo, Michigan. I'm a pastor of a small Lutheran house church there, about 35 members. And I'm going to attempt in the next hour to introduce you somewhat to Thomas Merton. Before I do that, I want to ask a question. I like to play some games sometimes with friends of mine. I'll say, put down on a piece of paper what you consider to be the 10 most important, the 10 greatest books ever written. And just get different opinions from people, what they think the 10 greatest books ever written was. Or put down on a piece of paper the 10 books that have influenced you the most. And those almost never are the 10 most important. The two lists are never the same. You know, you have these profound books over here, and then over here you have, well, the book, you know, The Little Prince influenced me the most, or some, you know, whatever. But I'd like to start out here just by asking a question like this, and this might be just fun, just share it. There's no right or wrong answer. It'd be kind of interesting just to see how different people feel about this. Let's go out to, oh, let's say 500 years from now, and history is being written 500 years from now. There's flies around my ears, too. I'm not batty. And who living in the 20th century, now we've lived through 80-some years of the 20th century, who is going to be remembered 500 years from now? Who do you think will be, you know, will stand out in people's minds 500 years from now as well, those were the people of the 20th century that will be important, that will be continue to be noticed or paid attention to or read? Who do you think?
Einstein.
Schweitzer?
Mother Teresa.
Mother Teresa? She's given us all of them. Come on, the rest of you. Dorothy Day?
Martin Luther King?
Anybody else? Gandhi? Tolstoy? Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Henry Nouwen? If you're real particular, you say Henri or something, but he calls himself Henry. Anybody else? Got Thomas Merton.
All right.
Well, I think it's kind of fun to do, because if you look back 500 years and see who do you remember, I think sometimes you say St. Francis, and we pray this a couple of St. Francis prayers, and you say, you know, Da Vinci or people like that. I think, who in the world were the important political figures at the time of St. Francis? I don't even know. But nobody mentioned John Kennedy, or nobody mentioned Jimmy Carter, or Nikita Khrushchev, or, you know, the people who are really making big news now. It's people like
remember Nixon.
Mother, no, I doubt. I don't think Nixon, well, they might. But, okay, I think that, I want to just say it's kind of baldly, because what I'd like to have you do is stir up some interest in your heart for Thomas Merton. And I think in my own mind that there's a good probability that 500 years from now, some, not all, because he wrote too much, but some of the distillation of Merton will be things that will be read by people who are interested in the history of Christianity. There's a probability, I believe, that Merton some of his writings may be something like what we think of as reading Teresa of Avila today, or John of the Cross, or Francis of Assisi, or possibly. Now, I could be 100% wrong, but I'll make it kind of strong like that. How many of here, if I say Thomas Merton, could string together 25 words or more that would be intelligible about Merton? How many think that you could say 25 or more intelligible words about Thomas Merton? Okay, just about three. In other words, I assume the rest of you don't know anything about Thomas Merton.
I'll say I've never heard of him. It wouldn't be very intelligent.
Huh?
Never heard of him.
Never heard of Thomas Merton. Okay. Thomas Merton, I'd like to take about maybe 10 minutes to give a very rapid biographical thumbnail sketch of Merton, which isn't going to really say a whole lot about him. Then say a few things about what I think he's done, and then read some things from some of the things that I like, and they may not be, they probably won't be the most profound things that he wrote. Thomas Merton was a Roman Catholic monk, and I first heard of Thomas Merton about 12 years ago when a teenager, about 15 or 16-year-old young fellow, came up to me and said, "What do you think of Thomas Merton?" And I said, "Who's he?" And he said, "Well, he's a monk." And I said, "Well, monks don't impress me a whole lot. To me, a monk is somebody who just sort of drops out of society. I'm thinking of monasteries out in the desert somewhere where people just sort of got fed up with the evils of the world and just went off and disappeared, and that's the last you heard of them, and they spent the rest of their life sitting around praying or doing whatever monks do or something like that. And that's basically what I said to this 15-year-old young man. And that was the end of the conversation. Now, I wish I could find that kid and talk with him again, because a 15-year-old who in 1968 or 69 or 70 who knew Thomas Merton, I'm really impressed about that. I was living in Pittsburgh at the time, and some time after that, there opened in Pittsburgh something called the Thomas Merton Center. Now, it was essentially kind of a place for Catholics who were basically kind of on the left side of the stream of Catholic thought and action in the 60s and early 70s. And I even went to the Thomas Merton Center a couple times for some meetings, never asked who Thomas Merton was. I mean, I didn't get through my head, okay? Thomas Merton was a man, he was born, I may get some of the facts wrong here, but I'll give you the gist of it. He was born about 1915. His father was a painter, an artist, and his mother was I can't say a whole lot about her. I don't know too much about her, and she died when Merton was about 6 years old, so I know that she was a Quaker, but occasionally attended Quaker meetings. Merton's father, as far as I could tell from reading about him, was not religious at all, except that artists, I think, are religious, but they didn't belong to any church. Merton was not brought up with any religious training at all. And because his father was an artist and traveled, Merton bounced around from country to country. He had quite a cosmopolitan childhood and upbringing. I think he was born in France. He lived in France part of the time. He lived in England. He lived in the United States. He lived in a few other places as his father moved around to paint. And Merton was educated partly in France, partly in England, and also in the United States. And he really considered himself, I think, more than anything an American. Boy, there's a fly around my head. It's driving me nuts. Just be careful. Merton, at least he did part of his undergraduate work, I think, at Cambridge, but he did the bulk of it at Columbia University in New York, and graduate work and stuff like that there. And he was a fairly, I would say a moderate hedonist during all this period, up to about the age of 27. Merton was a bit of a rounder, actually. I don't think he was a horrible guy, but he drank a lot, I think, or at least a fair amount. He talks about that in his autobiography. He wasted a lot of time. He romanced a little bit, all that kind of stuff. And finally, he was converted to Catholicism. And this partly was due to some professors he had at the University of Columbia. I think partly it was just the hollowness of his own life really began to, he had to come to somehow to grips with that, and ended up becoming a Christian and becoming a Roman Catholic Christian, in fact. Well, then, Merton, I think, was quite an intense guy, and he never did anything quite halfway. I'm going to take my glasses off, so if I hit that fly, non-violent little love tap there, I won't break my glasses.
He could hit himself.
Well, I thought it would land back here.
Anyway, once he decided to become a Christian, then it was, I think, somewhat typical of Merton to want to go into it, you know, tooth and nail and hammer and tongs and really commit himself. And he wrestled with this for quite a few years. He was still living something of the life of a dandy in New York City, and struggling with what his vocation might be. He was also, I should say, a writer, and that was, I think, what he thought he was going to be. He wrote with friends quite a few novels. Most of the novels that he wrote in these earlier years he burned. There's only one novel that he kept, and that finally was published in, under the title My Argument with the Gestapo. That was a novel. But the rest of the stuff he burned. And he continued to struggle with carrying his Christian faith somewhat deeper, For a while, he taught at a Catholic college, which his name's escaped me, St. Bonaventure, I think it was. He thought he might feel a call to become a Franciscan monk, but he had checked into the Franciscans, who were, you know, named after St. Francis and all that tradition of poverty, and found out they were very wealthy and quite lax, and that wasn't strenuous enough for him. For a while, he spent time in Harlem with Dorothy Day. He lived for a while at the Catholic Worker House there and was drawn towards that, and also another woman whose name is Catherine Dehick Daugherty, who is still living, and she's up in Canada. Some of you may have heard of her. She's written books. I saw at least one of her books in the bookstore here. And she also had a ministry in the inner city of New York, and was really calling Thomas Merton to join with her community and minister among the poor and the minorities and all that kind of thing in the city of New York. So he had exposure to that. But somehow, around 1940-41, he began to investigate an order of monks known as the Order of the Cistercians of the Strict Observance. Now that sounds like a horrible thing to get into. They are sometimes known as the Trappists. And I guess when you think of a monk, you're just the typical kind of idea of what a monk is. You may be thinking of a Trappist, because one of their vows is the vow of silence. And so great periods of time in a Trappist monastery are spent in absolute silence. They don't talk to each other. They do use some kind of a sign language where they can communicate past the salt or something at the table. But it's very little speech. It's a very strict order. It's a very hard life. They farm. They raise all their own food. They spend a great deal of time keeping the canonical hours of the day and prayer and all that kind of stuff. And Merton felt this call to become a Trappist, and he entered the Trappist monastery in 1941, which was about the time that World War II was beginning. So he entered the monastery when he was about 27 years old, and he entered on December 10th, I think, 1941, and he died on December 10th, 1968. So he was 27 years prior to the monastery and then 27 years in the monastery. His life just fell into two halves. He died a fairly untimely death. He went on a trip to the Far East. He was to speak at a conference of Asiatic Catholic monasteries, invited to speak there, and by accident he took a bath. He got out of a bathtub, and there was apparently a large fan in the room. He had bare feet, standing on a terrazzo floor. He touched the fan, and there was a short circuit in it, and he was electrocuted. So that's how he died. And he was about 58 years old, or 57, or something like that. During the 27 years that he was in the monastery, he very, very rarely left it. So he spent 27 years almost entirely enclosed in a monastery. I should mention the monastery is called Gethsemane, and it's in Kentucky. Still there, a lot of monks are still down there, and I have friends who have gone occasionally to spend a week at the monastery in Kentucky where Thomas Merton spent half of his life. He only left in the 27 years, I think, two or three times to go to a conference or something. Those monks don't get permission to wander around the world a whole lot. Okay, so that's basically the biography, and I did that in about the time that I wanted to do it in. I don't exactly know how to get into talking with you about the importance of Thomas Merton. I'm going to hit at it maybe in a couple ways. I'm going to emphasize at least one aspect that's only one little facet of him. He was extremely complex person. He must have been a high-energy guy, because I have a book at home that's about that thick. It's just a bibliography of what he's written. And he has like 50 or 60 books that have been published of his writings. There are hundreds of articles in magazines, journals, some of them rather obscure things that we don't read that often, monastic kind of journals or a contemplative review and stuff like that. Because of his international upbringing, he had a great facility in languages. So he wrote articles and stuff in French and Portuguese and Spanish, as well as in English, and a lot of his things have been translated into other languages. Let me get at it. One way to get at it would be something like this. If you don't see that the bomb is a tremendous threat in our culture, it's a kind of an apocalyptic threat, that doesn't seem to connect at all in your mind, there's not any likelihood that you're going to do a whole lot about resisting the bomb. And I guess I would say that if you don't see that the world that our world right now is in a profound crisis, perhaps one that is aptly symbolized by the bomb with a capital B, then you won't perceive Merton as important either. I guess I'd try to preface what I have to say about Merton is that our world is in a profound crisis, not just because of the bomb, I mean, but because of things that are more deep-seated than that. That's only a symbol of it. And one of those things I guess I'd say is that religion in the West is virtually at a state of exhaustion. That is traditional religion. A business as usual kind of Christianity in the West has been usurped and gutted and absorbed by the surrounding culture. Now, that's not an original statement with me. I think the person who posed that kind of a question most profoundly in his own life was Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And someone mentioned Bonhoeffer as one who might be remembered out of our time. I mean, Bonhoeffer said, the principal heresy of our time, now get this, this is a simple sentence, but he said the principal heresy is the assumption that Western cultural Christianity is Christian. Now, that's a shocking statement, but it's meant to shock. And Bonhoeffer said that like now 40, 50 years ago. And when I talk about our time being in a kind of crisis, I don't mean 1982. I mean, let's say, the 20th century. We have to be able to start thinking in a little longer terms, I guess, to catch what I'm trying to say here. But that was Bonhoeffer's assessment. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, our Lutheran, the great martyr of the 20th century in our religious heritage, says that the principal heresy is the assumption that our Western cultural Christianity is Christian. And I think that looking back, we can see the stark truth of Bonhoeffer's judgments on German Christianity in particular and Western Christianity generally. And I've often, you know, thought that in my own mind, how could millions of Christian and primarily Lutheran Christian Germans just fall into the barbarities of Hitlerism and Nazism? I still can't figure that out. You know, these were all good people. They're Christian people, Lutheran people, like you and like me. What in the world happened? Well, that's just a question. It sort of symbolizes, I think, the culture. Okay, now Thomas Merton comes along and he's seeking a couple of things. I have to leap over a whole lot of his own development to get to this, to just say a couple of things he was seeking. One was to discover the religious roots of humanity. I mean, Merton started out as a pretty narrow-minded Catholic. And some people want to know, well, where would be a good place to start reading Thomas Merton? And he wrote an autobiography called The Seven Story Mountain, and that was finished and published early after he became a monk. Well, if that could be a good place for someone to begin reading Thomas Merton, if you can filter through some of the strident, narrow-minded Catholic viewpoints that are in it. I mean, even in late in life, Merton changed so much, he said that the person who wrote Seven Story Mountain is dead. That's how much he felt he had changed. But the book is still good. but he went from, you know, almost saying Catholicism is it. I mean, that's where it's to be found. And he began to open himself up to other religious traditions and within the Christian family. And by the end of his life, had radically kind of opened himself to Eastern religions, non-Christian, especially Buddhism and Zen. And Zen's not exactly a religion, but remaining a committed, deeply committed Catholic Christian. when I say opened himself to those religions, I don't mean that he embraced them, but he built a bridge there. That was one of the things he did on this trip when he went east and was where he died, I think, was building some significant bridges between Christianity and some of the Eastern religions. Okay, so to discover the religious roots of humankind was one thing he tried to do, and to uncover a sense of his own authentic self was the other thing. And to do that, he had to die in one way or another, and I think that Merton gives us a good example of what it means to die unto self, not necessarily literally die, but to really die. And in a sense, when he said the person who wrote Seven Story Mountain is dead, there was almost a literal truth to that. I think that Thomas Merton intuited the bankruptcy of the religion he had inherited. That is, I mean, his Catholic Christianity. He intuited there was a bankruptcy. He was deeply educated and steeped in Thomism, Cartesian Christianity, theology, and what have you, but he saw that the surface of all that was pretty dried up in his day. And he read the mystics. He read the Desert Fathers. St. John of the Cross, a mystical theologian, was deeply influential on him, along with St. Teresa of Avila, another mystical person. And I think those readings and that deep immersion in that kind of mystical theology prepared him for a comprehension of Eastern religions. Islam, Sufi, Buddhism, but especially Zen. One writer puts it this way, that Merton got beneath the surface of his Christian verbiage and started digging, and he dug so deep that he came out on the other side of the world, but he still remained a Christian. Well, what happened in Merton? I guess I'll put it like this, out of his deep acceptance of Christianity, he died to all the forms and patterns of Western Christianity. Now let that sentence just dangle out there. In a sense, he took on the task within his own body of transcending his nation, culture, religious forms, and time, and everything else. And the important thing I think I'm emphasizing here is relationship with religions of the East, but that's just one facet of him. The thing that I think is important to keep in mind is that Merton didn't just try to graft some branches of Eastern forms of religion onto the dead theological branches of Western cultural Christianity, because that would be like pouring new wine into old wineskins. The old had to die first, and in a sense, the old forms and assumptions and all that sort of died within Thomas Merton. And Merton would say to us, as he said to himself, that the death he's talking about has to take place somewhere deep inside of ourselves, not abstractly, not out there. I'll read a couple things later that will kind of illustrate that, I think. So I would say an age is dying. That would be just an assertion that I'd make. We're living in an age that's dying, and it's maybe even dead. And the symbol of, there are many symbols of that in our culture, that is, the symbols that we worship death. And a new age is not really fully born yet. And I kind of guess I would say Merton is like the midwife. He is one who is helping to give birth to something new. I used illustration a couple times a week or two ago about a finger pointing at the moon. That's a Buddhist story, I think, or no, I don't know, it's a Chinese story, I guess, but a finger pointing at the moon, the important thing is the moon, not the finger. I mean, it's important that the finger is there helping us to see the moon, but don't look at my finger. You know, it's you have a little child, and you try. You know, a little child about 2 years old, and you point to something, and they look at your finger. And at a certain point, they learn that is something else. Well, Merton is a finger. I mean, in a sense, Merton is pointing us to Christ. He's pointing us to God in our world, and in all people, and all things in our world. And in a sense, he's a very accurate finger, I think. I read someplace, and I can't remember exactly where this was, but and I can't recall who the writer was, but it's an intriguing statement. When the history of our age is written, this 20th century, basically, this would be like asking who will be remembered. What event will what will stand out as really a very important event or events? And I'm going to save time at telling you what this person said. It won't be even World War I and World War II. World War III would be a big event if it comes. That would be remembered. But this writer was saying that this age is a very subtle thing going on that a lot of people aren't aware of. It'll be the age in which Christianity and Buddhism penetrated one another deeply. Now, I don't know if you're aware that that's happening in the world or not. But it's possible. And I think possibly that's, I'm not saying that's all there is to Thomas Merton, because that would be to misrepresent him a great deal, but the interpenetration of Buddhism and Christianity, and especially Zen. And I think Merton learned a lot of things from Zen. This is, I'm talking now about the last 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2 years of his life. I doubt if very many of us here know much of anything about Zen, but one of the things I learned about Zen is it's not a religion, not necessarily a religion at least, or a philosophy. It's a way of being toward the world. It's a way of listening and even hearing. It's a way of looking and hopefully seeing, which there's a difference between listening and hearing and looking and seeing. And the whole approach to the Zen life is contemplative. And our Western civilization is the extreme opposite from the contemplative way. Even in the church, contemplation is a pretty suspect thing. But in our Western society, I think that I at least perceive that there is quite a bit of disillusionment with materialism. There is a sense that a kind of self-centered life that we are immersed in doesn't somehow satisfy. Henry Nouwen says we are filled but not fulfilled, and we sense that there's a lack of fulfillment in our lives. And so there are people who this maybe is just kind of a fad or trendy thing right now, is to kind of turn to Eastern religions. That's not what Merton did at all. But I know that there is a trendy kind of thing in our society of looking at gurus and guys who come over here from India and other those kind of religions. And I think that does, to some degree, come out of a sense of unfulfillment of particularly young people in our culture. I know a woman in my hometown who's 30 years old, maybe. She's absolutely a normal, ordinary person, got two kids and a husband, and she's become a Sikh. It's a branch of Hinduism, I think. And she's dead serious about it. I mean, I've known her for 5 or 6 years. She's been a Sikh all those years, and she wears a distinctive garb of a Sikh, which is all white garb with a kind of a white turban on her head. And when I first met her, I thought she was a nurse who was off duty. And found out that's not what... Okay, she's found something there. Merton's... I think that Merton is... A lot of Merton's writing has to do with monastic renewal, and we may not be that interested in the renewal of monasteries. We may not even think they're worth renewing. I personally do. I think there is a... We have gotten perhaps a wrong idea of what a monastery or a monk is. But I think that what he has to say about renewal, monastic renewal in our generation or our age, applies almost exactly to the church as well. So when I read Merton now, I can almost, when he says monastery, I can almost translate it church and just keep right on reading the sentence and it makes sense to me. What Merton did, I think, was to bring together two things that we may see as contradictory or mutually exclusive. And one is contemplation and the other one is action. And I think my sense of what went on in the 60s in our country with this big explosions of actions and activism and all that kind of stuff was there was very little contemplation going on behind it. And the people that I know who were active in the 60s and who are still active and significantly making a contribution are those who had some kind of deep spiritual and contemplative roots under what they were doing. Those who didn't have those roots blew their wad in a year or so and then went off and got a job for General Motors or something like that. Merton embodied in his own being contemplation and action. Now, that's not to say that Merton was an activist in the popular sense of the word. Like, he never went on a demonstration. He never walked in a civil rights demonstration. He never went to anti-war Vietnam demonstration. He was in the monastery. But in a sense, from the monastery, he was removed enough from the front lines that he could see what the picture was looking like. Plus the fact that he was going very deep down inside of himself and seeing his own connection with the violence, the racism, the upheaval and stuff that was going on out there. So that would be kind of another way of saying what happened. Okay, Martin Marty is a Lutheran guy. You probably all heard about Martin Marty. I don't think he'll be remembered 500 years from now, but he might be. But at one point, Merton had written a very strong criticism of what was going on. I think it was on the racial situation in this country. And Merton wrote that to white liberals. I mean, some of his devastating stuff is really surprise you. Written directed at white liberals and what they saw as solutions to the racial problems. And Marty wrote a very caustic letter to the editor or something that said, "Keep your mouth shut, Merton. You don't know what's going on. You're living down there in Kentucky behind these walls. And who are you, secluded monk, who dropped out of the world to make any comments about what's happening in Harlem or what's happening in Watts or what's happening in the South?" And everything that Merton had said about the situation turned out ultimately to be true. And Martin Marty was a big man and wrote a lengthy apology for his criticism some years later and said, "Merton, you were right. I didn't see it." But you see, the monk has seen some things. Okay, our time is rapidly passing, and I'd like to read a little bit to you from Merton, because all I can do really is create the awareness of the man and give you enough of a taste to say, well, maybe I'd like to read some more. I started out by saying that that Dietrich Bonhoeffer posed in his body, in his life, not intellectually, but in his very life, Dietrich Bonhoeffer posed some questions. And I'd suggest that Thomas Merton, in his body, in his life, and which is revealed to us, I think, primarily through his writings, too, incarnated some answers to the questions that Bonhoeffer raised. So if you'd like to do some theology sometime, that if you feel heady enough to do that, is to dig around a little bit in Bonhoeffer and see what it was that he was critiquing about Western Christianity, and then dig around a little bit in Merton and see Merton gives us the pointers to some answers. Questions like, is Christianity in the West, at least, dead? That's a hard question to even face, because I'm a Western Christian and I don't like to even think about the fact that I may belong to a dead religion. Dietrich Bonhoeffer could think about that. Is Christianity, as we know it in our Western culture, a culture Christianity? Much like, say, in Russia under the Tsars, where the Christian Orthodox Church was so linked with the whole Tsarist system that when the Tsarist system went, so did the church. Or another question that Bonhoeffer posed is, how do we live in a post-Christian era? That was a Bonhoeffer, I think he coined the phrase, we live in a post-Christian era. What does that mean? Is renewal for us in the Western Church even possible? Bonhoeffer also coined the phrase religionless Christianity. Can there be such a thing? Well, okay, if I can just sort of blow your image of what a monk is like, the paradox that Merton lived in the belly of a paradox, he was a contemplative living in a cloistered monastery who had deep insight into issues like racism and war and violence and idolatry, world issues. I mean, he knew what was going on. Partly, I think, because he lived in Harlem. Partly because he worked with Catherine de Heek Daugherty. He was a hedonist who became a monk. He was a hermit because even in the monastery, he finally left the community in the monastery and lived within the confines of the enclosure in a little cabin way back in the woods as a hermit. But he was famous. I mean, those are almost a contradiction in terms. He was a famous person while he lived. He was a cloistered monk who profoundly was conscious of the world's problems. He was a person who had committed himself to the discipline of silence and yet became a prophet. He was one who had a vocation of solitude but became a spokesperson for the peace movement. He was a devout, and I want to emphasize this so you don't get the wrong impression, a deeply devout Christian who was also considered by the other side of the world as a Zen master. And that's just amazing. And he was outspoken, incredibly outspoken, saying things which really were not popular in the Catholic hierarchy and structures, and yet profoundly obedient to his monastic superiors. And at one time, they silenced him. They said, "Tom, you can't write any more about peace." And Tom said, "Okay, I won't." And his reasons for that, you have to dig them out of some book, are, I think, very, very instructive. He practiced a profound nonviolence toward his superiors. He realized that just by rebelling against them or by leaving the monastery, he would do more harm than good to the peace issue. And he stayed obedient to his vow of obedience to his superiors. And, you know, two or three years later, they recanted their silencing of him. They were very embarrassed because all the things that he said began to also come out in Vatican II, and they proved Tom was right again. Okay, let me read a couple things to you. We got just not too much time left here. I want to read... First thing I want to read, so I don't miss this, this would be kind of fun, because I've said a lot of heavy things about him, and I want to say some things here now that give you the idea that he wasn't quite, he had a great sense of humor. One of the first things I heard about him, even before I read any of his things, Tom Merton, he said, if anybody would go to the monastery and would get a chance to meet with him, and that might not be easy, because his superiors may not let a visitor just come and sit down with him. He said, Merton would say, okay, if you want to talk to me, you got to sit here under this tree with me, take your shoes off and drink a beer. I don't know, some of you may not think drinking beer is good. This is a little article that's written by Jim Forrest, who is real involved in the Catholic branch of the peace movement. He was part of the Catholic Worker House, working with Dorothy Day in New York City, one of those houses where anybody, poor, drunk, homeless, could come in, they'd be given a meal, a bed. I mean, that's the Catholic worker style, a very chaotic sort of a house that just is open to anybody who needs the gospel and who needs to be ministered to. Jim Forrest is a young guy who's working with the Catholic Worker newspaper, and he leaves New York City with a friend of his by the name of Bob Kay, and they hadn't met Merton, they never met him, but they'd read some of his stuff. And they hitchhiked from New York to this obscure place in the hills of Kentucky to meet Thomas Merton in January. So it's a cold time. And this is what he says about his meeting Thomas Merton. In January 1962, Merton proposed a visit. The next month after, this was February then, getting the paper to press, I began to hitchhike to Kentucky with a poet friend, Bob Kay, bringing along nothing except the latest issue of the paper and a few loaves of bread fresh from Spring Street Italian Bakery. It was an exhausting three-day pilgrimage. Now, we camped our way out here. It took us 11 days, and one of the criteria with my 17-year-old daughter for picking the next campsite was, do they have a shower? I mean, if they don't have a shower, I don't want to camp there. Here are these guys on the road hitchhiking in 3 days, long waits in remote places in ferocious weather. When we arrived and were shown to our cells in the guest house, Bob collapsed on his bed while I found my way through fire doors and connecting passageways to a loft in the back of the monastery's barn-like church. It's a very pious Jim Forrest. He gets down there and he hasn't even met Burton yet, but he's going to go to this church where the monks all say the their prayers, I guess. And he says, surviving the trip, a prayer of thanksgiving came easily. But it didn't last long because the church's silence was broken by distant laughter. Laughter so intense and pervasive that I couldn't fail to be drawn to it. Such an unlikely sound for a solemn Trappist monastery. It was coming from the guest house. In fact, from Bob's room. A kind of monsoon of joy. Well, that's the difference between Bob and me, I thought. I pray, and he gives way to laughter. God probably likes the laughter better. I pushed open the door, and indeed Bob was laughing, but the sound was coming mainly from a monk on the floor in his black and white robes. I just pictured this, on his back, his feet flailing in the air, bright red face, hands clutching his belly. Now there's a monk in his Trappist robes, lying on his back and his feet up in the air, holding his belly, roaring with laughter. A shade more than Robin Hood's well-fed friar Tuck than I imagined a fast-chastened Trappist could be. Thomas Merton, author of so many books about such serious subjects, laughing half to death on the floor. And laughing about what? The answer came with my first gasp of air. The smell! What would have offended so many others delighted him. The room was like a fish market in a heat wave. Bob, after 3 days of rough travel without a change of socks, had taken off his shoes. Had there ever been so rude a scent in this scrubbed monastery's history? It was, in a way, the Catholic worker's social gospel incarnate. Its unwashed, impolite vocation, such as the church in all its cathedral glory had seldom seen since the first Franciscan 7 centuries ago. The Catholic worker in stocking feet had arrived indeed, announcing its sweaty message to the most non-attentive nose. It made the monk roar with pleasure until the need to breathe took precedence and there would be a shaking of hands and a more traditional welcome. Okay. Well, that's kind of gives you a picture. There's a lot of pictures like that of Thomas Merton. He was an earthy guy. In a lot of ways, he reminds me of Martin Luther. Merton didn't write any systematic theology. If you want to go to Merton and say, well, let me see what his Christology is, and let me see what his doctrine of God is, you won't find it, because he wrote like Luther in a lot of ways. Luther wrote, I mean, other people have put a lot of Luther's stuff together, but Luther was an active, I mean, in fact, Luther went into a monastery. I mean, he began his career as an Augustinian monk, but he saw the need for renewal in his age and left the monastery. Merton stayed in the monastery to do it. Let me see if I can find a couple of other things that I can read. I can't read all the things I've picked. I picked a lot of really good things, but let me read you this one. This is one that I think is one of my favorites, and it's extremely beautiful. This is from a book called Raids on the Unspeakable, and this is the first page and a half of an essay that, the whole essay is excellent, but I think this first page and a half is worth the price of the book. Let me say this before rain becomes a utility that they can plan and distribute for money. By they, I mean the people who cannot understand that rain is a festival, who do not appreciate its gratuity, who think that what has no price has no value, that what cannot be sold is not real, so that the only way to make something actual is to place it on the market. The time will come when they will sell you your rain. At the moment, it is still free, and I am in it. I celebrate its gratuity and its meaninglessness. Now, before I go to the next paragraph, I'll set the scene for you. He's in his hermitage, way back in the knobs of Kentucky Hills, nobody else in sight. His little cabin, sitting there all by himself. The rain I am in is not the rain of cities. It fills the woods with an immense and confused sound. It covers the flat roof of the cabin and its porch with insistent and controlled rhythms. And I listen, because it reminds me again and again that the whole world runs by rhythms I have not yet learned to recognize, rhythms that are not those of the engineer. I came up here from the monastery last night, sloshing through the cornfield, said vespers, and put some oatmeal on the Coleman stove for supper. It boiled over while I was listening to the rain and toasting a piece of bread at the log fire. The night became very dark. The rain surrounded the whole cabin with its enormous virginal myth, a whole world of meaning, of secrecy, of silence, of rumor. Think of it. All that speech pouring down, selling nothing, judging nobody, drenching the thick mulch of dead leaves, soaking the trees, filling the gullies and crannies of the wood with water, washing out the places where men have stripped the hillside, like the tailings out here. What a thing it is to sit absolutely alone in the forest at night, cherished by this wonderful, unintelligible, perfectly innocent speech. The most comforting speech in the world, the talk that rain makes by itself all over the ridges, and the talk of the watercourses everywhere in the hollows. Nobody started it. Nobody is going to stop it. It will talk as long as it wants, this rain. As long as it talks, I'm going to listen. Now that's partly what a contemplative does, is to not only listen to the rain, but hear the rain. There's a difference between listening and hearing. Okay, I got one thing I want to say in conclusion, and this will be just a little bit more serious, but it'll again set up, I think, something maybe we could talk about if there's any time at all left. There's a cartoon I saw one time that showed Charlie Brown walking along with a sign that says, Jesus is the answer. And walking along behind him was Snoopy with a sign that says, what's the question? and that's really important, to ask the right question. And I think what Thomas Merton in a sense is saying to us is the question that we ask must be radical enough. We have to ask a radical enough question. And I don't have this with me. In fact, I can't remember where. I want to rely on my memory. This is from Thomas Merton, basically, but I can't recall exactly where I could find it. He says the question is not who will win the Cold War. It's not a radical enough question. The question is not will there be a nuclear war. The question is not will we win the nuclear war if there is one. Or the question is not will we beat the Russians or the Chinese or somebody else, or is capitalism superior? He said these questions are not radical enough. And the way he gets at the radical question is like this. He said God came to Cain and said to Cain, where is your brother? And Cain's answer was somewhat ambiguous. And he says that that's an archetypal, I don't know how to say that dumb word. I know what it means, but archetypical question. The question that's posed to Cain is an archetypical question. Where is your brother? And Cain's answer is very fuzzy. Am I my brother's keeper? In other words, Merton says, the question is posed is something like, what are your true intentions? What do you really intend to do? Now the question, that archetypal question, is asked a second time in the Bible, and this time in the New Testament, and it's asked in the Garden of Gethsemane. And Jesus is there, and the disciples are there, and Judas is coming with some of these soldiers. And Jesus looks at Judas and says to Judas, friend, wherefore art thou come? Which, in Old English, it really kind of means, friend, what do you intend to do? What are your intentions? And Judas, who was a lot sadder than Cain, and a whole lot more sophisticated, knew that the answer had something to do with love. And so he kissed Jesus. I think that Merton stands like a huge question mark, asking the question of us, wherefore art thou come? What do you really intend to do? We've talked a lot about that here this past couple of weeks, but the question is addressed to me. And I think that Merton also stands as a huge exclamation point, burning the answer into whoever has ears to hear, the exclamation point at the end of a sentence that really is an awesome, holy silence. And that takes up about this whole blooming hour. I'll leave you a whole lot of time to ask any questions or discuss this at all. Maybe if you have a question. Okay, what should you read first? Well, if you're talking about reading Merton himself, that is a primary source, there are several places I think that you might be able to connect with him. One is a book called Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander. It's the one I got on the very top of the list there. And I don't have a copy of that here, but it's a book sort of like this one here. It's a journal. I mean, it's drawn from his journal, but it's not dated, you know, in a chronological way. It's things that he had in his journal. A lot of his writings are from his journals. And they're just sort of grouped in chapters around certain themes, and they range in length from like a paragraph to maybe a page. And you really can almost break Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander open any place and just read a page of it, and it's easy to read that way. I think that's a good one. You'll find some good things in it, and you'll find some dumb things in it. I mean, that's true of anybody, and especially journals. I mean, there are just days when you don't write anything decent in your journal, but there are some things that really will connect. That would be a good one. I think Raids on the Unspeakable, the one I read about rain, there's an essay in here, and the title of it will give you an idea, a little bit of his sarcasm, A Devout Meditation in Memory of Adolf Eichmann. If you recall who Adolf Eichmann was, this is a super good essay. It's about two or three pages, and in fact, I intended to read that whole essay here. It's about three pages, and I didn't leave myself enough time to do it. It'll blow you away. And basically, what he says in that essay is that we don't have to look out for the insane people. It's the sane people we have to watch out for. The most profound thing, the most disturbing thing to him in the trial of Adolf Eichmann. Do you know who Adolf Eichmann was? Am I talking about somebody you don't know? He said the most disturbing thing about it was that he was declared perfectly sane to stand trial. That's really disturbing. That would be a good one. New Seeds of Contemplation is an excellent one. That and Thoughts in Solitude, good places to start with right now. Any of those.